We open our show today with a professor of political science at Illinois Wesleyan University, the chair of the political science department. It is Greg Shaw joining us in studio. Greg, pleasure to have you along.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Absolutely. Big week or so for you. You've just released a new book, The Dysfunctional Politics of the Affordable Care Act. The book focuses on the politics surrounding the ACA, explaining how and why supporters and opponents have approached the issue of health care reform the way they have since the Act's passage in 2010. This will be your third book. And Greg, just for starters, what brought you to take on this topic?
Yeah, it's a follow-on to an earlier project that was more of a historical piece about the history of the argument over the debate over health care. Mm-hmm. I was inspired to take on this project, though, because as I watched Congress and the states and the White House argue about how to fashion how to address the fact that we spend an outrageous amount of money on healthcare, that I needed to understand how it is. I was interested in knowing how people come to understand healthcare policy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's complicated, and there are a lot of different stakeholders with different perspectives on this. And my sense was that this was a significant piece of legislation. I think it's the most significant one since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid back in 1965. And so it's an opportunity for the public to learn. So I was at least as interested in public discourse and public learning as I was in the healthcare policy per se. Mm. And obviously over the first several years of the law's life from 2010 forward, I saw a lot of, well, frankly, dysfunction. And I wanted to try to understand that.
Mm-hmm. What is the root of that? And I know that's a big question, and I know you hit on that. But one thing I know you focus on a lot is just kind of the way healthcare was perceived in the media. I mean, this was the first big – I think I was a senior in high school in 2009, and one of my first big forays into politics, I wrote a paper for my high school physics class about – I think it was on universal healthcare, because it was right when this topic was brewing. We started seeing some committee talk, and I just remember – a complete disconnect for how this issue was presented. You know, we had this talk of things like death panels, the way these were introduced.
Sure.
And I remembered as, a high school student there thinking, I think I know what's happening, but I'm getting this issue framed to me in so many different ways. Frankly, I was kind of lost. It was kind of my first dipping my toes into policy and thinking, how do you introduce this to people in a way that not only are they able to understand it, but actually getting real information?
Sure. That's a good set of insights. Several things come together to make this something like a perfect storm politically. Mm-hmm. The issues involved are not like, say, how we pave a highway. Rather, they're life and death issues, mm-hmm. literally. And, we lose tens of thousands of people in this country every year who could be saved had the right health care gotten to them or they got the right health care. Mm-hmm. And so it's literally matters of life and death. It's tremendously expensive, right? We spend about 17% of gross domestic product on that. So it's about a sixth of the nation's economy. So it's the second largest sector of the economy behind manufacturing. So it's huge. Mm-hmm. It maps really well onto the big government versus small government dimension that characterizes liberalism, conservatism. Mm. So as opposed to a quirky thing like maybe space exploration or foreign aid or something along those lines, it speaks to people's sense of how big or intrusive or big and helpful, depending on your point of view, the government is being. So I think for those reasons, among others, it gets people revved up about this issue in ways that we don't see in a lot of others.
Well, and you make the point that surveys show Americans trust their healthcare providers and not so much their politicians. So,
right.
I remember there was another big thing when people found out that, wow, maybe the line of everyone will keep their doctor. Oh, my goodness, I might be losing my doctor under this new plan. These politicians have lied to me. And then it just blows up the entire,
sure.
Maybe there are a lot of good things in the ACA for that particular person, but just losing their doctor alone, their physician, it totally flipped the script on them. So talk about the personal nature of healthcare and the way Americans, because it seems like this is a uniquely American thing that we are this much invested in our healthcare.
Well, that's one way to put it, this much invested. We spend, no matter how you measure this, mm-hmm. whether it's a percentage of GDP or a per capita basis or however, we spend more than any other country on Earth by far. So Switzerland often comes in second place. They're at a 12 or 13% of GDP, and we're over 17. So we are unique in that sense. I was struck this last semester when my students in class wrestled with the and had to present summaries of other countries' healthcare systems to a person. They came back and said, "Wow, some version of, you know, this can be done differently, and it is done differently. It doesn't have to be government centered necessarily, but we have kind of a messy hybrid arrangement where a lot of government dollars go to private providers, and so whether that's, you know, managed care under Medicare or Medicaid." Or whether that's a government subsidy buying an individual's insurance. There's this hybrid between private dollars and public dollars that leads to some redundancy and some waste, for sure. There are other issues at work there too, but that complicates things. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the idea of your personal relationship with your doctor or other practitioner, mm-hmm. you know, that's really personal. You know that person. This isn't just some bureaucrat in some faraway place. You know this person. They've perhaps saved your life, mm-hmm. right? And there's a high level of trust there. So anything that looks like it's going to interfere with the doctor-patient relationship is upsetting both the patients, but also obviously mm-hmm. to medical practitioners.
And something else you hit on in the book is the unpopularity of the individual mandate with
right.
the ACA. And
right.
you kind of say that Democrats in Washington may have underestimated just how unpopular
absolutely.
That was going to be. Where was the disconnect there?
Sure. It'll helps perhaps to understand briefly where that idea came from. Back in 2006, when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he worked out an arrangement with his democratically controlled legislature mm-hmm. to implement what came to be called a sort of a three-legged stool of regulation on insurance providers to make sure that consumers are protected in the way that reasonable people would expect them to be. An individual requirement to obtain health insurance in order to tamp down on the cost shifting that occurs from free riders who end up in the emergency department without insurance, mm-hmm. but then a government subsidy to help you buy that insurance that you're being compelled to purchase. And so that three-legged arrangement of regulation, a mandate, and subsidies came to be a formula that Democrats picked up in 2009, 2010 in crafting the ACA. And mm-hmm. so they very much took the Massachusetts model and upscaled that. In that upscaling, there occurred some problems, right? So, for instance, Massachusetts had a very low uninsured rate, about 6% at the time. So that was a fairly easy problem gap to fill, mm-hmm. whereas at the national level, we had about a 17% uninsured rate. And so that upsizing of the Massachusetts idea to make it fit the nation came with, frankly, a lot more difficulties. The scaling up was a lot more complicated. And it makes people feel like they're being told you have to go conduct this transaction with a private provider, which chafes people, whether they're libertarians right. or not. It's irritating.
Well, and with that said, not to get too cliche, but we say a perfect storm. You know, this is right as the rise of the Tea Party and the freedom, and
right.
no one's going to tell me I have to have this.
That's right.
So
that combined with the high levels of government and spending involved in 2008 and 2009, mm-hmm. the Tea Party really came out of this, the stimulus plan that was initiated by the Bush administration and followed on by the Obama administration, mm-hmm. involved spending a lot of money in ways that a lot of people on the right found wasteful.
Yeah.
And then in quick succession, the ACA looked like not only spending a lot of money, but telling me what to do and how to live my life.
Right.
And so it absolutely fit with that narrative as well.
Did Democrats, I know obviously they underestimated a little bit of the backlash there, but did they see the rise of the Tea Party? Were they concerned with that, the far right groups gaining power? I know it wasn't until the 2010 midterms that they really took power, but did they see that coming and to the extent that it actually happened?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. There mm-hmm. were Democratic pollsters who were trying to warn Democratic leaders that, mm-hmm. you know, the stuff is going to hit the fan if you pass this in its current form. I don't think, though, that Democratic leadership anticipated just how negative it would be. They designed the implementation of the law, the phase-in, to get the popular provisions up front. So one of the first things that happened was that Medicare recipients received a $250 check in the mail to help with prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. So that's cash in hand, right? And it's pure political profit.
Mm-hmm.
And the harder thing provisions came later. And so they tried to ease people into it, but they didn't do a good enough job of selling it. And they didn't do a good enough job of explaining just how much assistance would be available from government.
And with that said, let's kind of take this conversation to the present day. We just had the American Health Care Act through Congress with all sorts of, we'll say, controversy. Now it's sitting in the hands of the Senate where they're just, I imagine, torpedoing what this is looking like. It's just going to be completely different. Are there lessons to be learned from the ACA for senators right now tinkering away at what this legislation is going to look like?
Certainly. As the ACA itself built on a lot of prior experiences, either at the federal or at state levels, mm-hmm. The American Healthcare Act will build on the ACA. So as much as there's language of, you know, complete repeal and so forth, that's not really what will happen if the American Healthcare Act does indeed pass. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the Republican version that passed the House, it still includes a lot of consumer protections. Kids get to stay on parents' insurance until they're 26 and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans have borrowed some of the more successful components of the ACA to keep them right in place.
Right.
For obviously, you know, political reasons, mm-hmm. Then they're going after some other things that are either expensive or controversial. Mm-hmm. So they've softened the individual mandate. So the mandate per se goes away, but then they would presumably, it looks like, allow insurers to jack up premiums on people who allow their insurance to lapse. Mm-hmm. So that's not exactly a tax penalty, but it's a financial penalty in another form.
Yeah.
So yes, it will be a mix of building on the known and the popular, but also branching out in some of the directions.
What do you think the public's going to react to this? Because what I've been amazed to see is that over time, we seem to be seeing more and more support for the ACA.
Yeah.
I think the recent support was at something like 60%.
And that's meaningful, right?
Right.
So one of the observations is that the ACA has become more popular mm-hmm. since Obama left office.
Right.
So a big portion of the animus toward the ACA was really irritation with Obama as a person. Mm-hmm. So now that we don't have to call this Obamacare anymore, at some point the Republicans own whatever policy we have, mm-hmm. whether it's inherited or newly fashioned. Mm-hmm. And so getting rid of Obama was part of getting rid of the negativity of Obamacare, right?
It's interesting because I've heard that sentiment that a lot of it was Obamacare, and we even heard of people in rural, you know, red states learning that Obamacare was the Affordable Care Act.
Sure.
And thinking, oh my goodness, I had no idea.
This is my coverage, whether it's public, private, whatever.
Right.
Right. Right.
That's very interesting. So how do you think this new piece of legislation, we don't have a whole lot of time here, but how is this going to get branded? You know, people are trying to call this Trump Care, Ryan Care, whatever you want to call it. I mean, are there going to be similar branding issues, for lack of a better term?
Yes. I don't know what it will ultimately be called.
Sure.
I guess that's a function of sort of what label sticks and grabs people's attention, yeah. right? And part of it is, you know, okay. But I think, you know, something will get passed because the Republicans, I think, will have a difficult time seeing themselves being taken seriously in the 2018 elections mm-hmm. if they don't pass some kind of revision that they can then claim as a retooling mm-hmm. and an improvement in some way. Obviously, the president will engage in hyperbole as he does about this being all new and completely better and so on and so forth. Others may be more subdued about that, mm-hmm. but I think we'll end up with something passed. But I would not look for another policy earthquake here. Mm-hmm. I would not look for the new policy to be as different from the ACA as the ACA was different from its immediate predecessor, mm-hmm. a set of policies.
All right. And before we let you go, Greg, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but when do we see a finalized bill landing on the president's desk?
Right.
Is that even something we can?
You're right. Right. I don't have a crystal ball. I mean, they want to get it done before the August recess.
Right.
The signs coming out of the Senate are that's not going to happen. As much as Mitch McConnell has said it's going to happen, I'd be somewhat surprised. Congress has a way of passing less legislation in election years. So as we go into 2018. Members will posture, the opposition will become more stubborn, and so if the Republicans have a better chance, not a great chance, but a better chance of passing something, mm-hmm. I would look for it to happen this calendar year rather than next.
All right. Very good. That is Greg Shaw, professor of political science at Illinois Wesleyan University and the author of The Dysfunctional Politics of the Affordable Care Act. Before we let you go, Greg, where can we get our hands on this book? Where's the best place to go?
The easiest stop would be Amazon.com.
There you go. Dysfunctional Politics of the Affordable Care Act. Greg Shaw, our guest. Greg, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to have you on again soon.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.